been just a little while since I've taught an adult class. I taught the junior high class the last couple times I taught, so I forgot how great it is. The conversations after the class are wonderful, but inevitably it's a point. Somebody brings a point up and you're like, why didn't I think of that? Or I should have brought that out. I'm not smart enough to even think of that. And then, of course, you've got Ron on one side going, slow down, and Stephen's over here doing this. So the joys of an adult class. So we will continue plugging away this morning and hopefully finish Job and get started on Proverbs. All right, we got through the last things. We looked at the speeches by the three men, the three friends. Then we looked at some statements that Job made that showed his obvious frustration with them as things progressed. You know, we talked about the conversation started honestly. I think they were sincere in their belief as they began. But they grew increasingly frustrated with Job as he did with them as it went along. So then that brings us to think about some questions or some statements by Job that may have elicited that reaction. And elicited it spelled correctly there. I had it wrong in the questions. Sometimes you don't listen when Apple tells you you're doing something wrong, and you should have. But look at those statements that may have elicited the reaction that he got from God a little bit later. There are a lot of statements through the book that give me that feeling as I read them. Things that I don't know that I would feel comfortable saying to the Lord. Or about the Lord. But everything that he says, we have to remember God's statement at the end of the book that Job, my servant Job, has spoken what was right concerning me as he spoke to the three friends. So while there was some questionable things that he said, all in all, it's tempered by that comment from the Lord. So we need to keep that in mind. To me, the thing that Job, it was kind of twofold. That he felt he could demand an answer from the Lord, I think is kind of the impression I get. And that he could make an argument for why God should answer him, I think to me are the sins or where he was guilty, where he fell guilty. We'll look through a few statements here that I have, and then any others you have and comments you have we'll look at. So there in chapter 10, verses 2 and 3 and verses 7, beginning in verse 2, he says, I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you to contend to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? And then dropping down to verse 7, according to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. So, of course, there he's espousing his innocence and questioning why God is punishing him. Over in chapter 13, in verse 3, and this is just a very small selection of some of the statements that Job made that may have been the cause of God's reaction. 13 and 3, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God. New American Standard there translates that argue, and I thought, well, maybe it's not the word argue as we use it, but as I look it up, I mean, it is translated a little bit differently in some places, but a lot of times it is argue and contend. So that was Job's point there. Down in verse 22 of that same chapter, then call and I will answer, or let me speak, then reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. So again, demanding an answer of God. Over in chapter 19 and verse 7. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. And then he goes on to say, he has walled up my way. He stripped me of honor. He breaks me down on every side. So that accusation of what God was doing to him and his cry that it wasn't right. I would fill my mouth with arguments, and the upright would reason with him there in chapter 23 as he starts out, I think the chapter there talking about he didn't know where to find God. He didn't know where to approach him. But if he did, I would fill my mouth with arguments. I would tell God why I'm right, why he should answer me. So I think that's one of the errors that Job had in his statements. And then there in 31 and 35, let the Almighty answer me. Thoughts? Any other scriptures that jump out to you? Statements that jump out to you?
It is all one thing. Their scourge slays suddenly the pride of the innocent. If it is not God, the one who causes this to happen.
Yeah, I think Trevor had. Yeah, Trevor had brought that verse out a little bit later, talking about there is no mention of Satan outside the mentions that of God speaking to him there, these men or Job, either one. Which you'll find out he doesn't exactly want by the end. And I guess when I say I have a hard time with it, look at the men that wrote the Psalms and look at Job, look at their character and where they come from. I mean, it's from a righteous place, that's for sure. Any argument they make, all in all, is from a righteous place. All right, any others before we move on? Yeah, that's one of my final points on the last lessons that we can take from Job. That verse along with, I know my Redeemer lives, and then I'll see him, he'll stand before me. So yeah, very much so. No, absolutely not. We looked at the verse Wednesday night where he told God, he said, I can't breathe. One after other, you know, he lost his children, he lost all of his wealth, he lost his health, and then the three friends and his wife turned on him. So, yes, that definitely had a big effect on him. Probably written in poetry, maybe.
I believe it was put to poetry.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of what I've surmised. Or they may have spoken that way, I don't know. All right, moving on. Beginning in chapter 32, then we come across the fourth visitor. What was his name? Who was he?
Elihu.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Puts him in the lineage of Jesus, which is pretty incredible. Excuse me. He describes himself as young. He knows he's young. He's respectful of these older men, these elders that have been speaking. He's shy even. He says that at one point. He's afraid to speak. But then he finishes up there in chapter 32 in verse 18. I love his description there. He says, for I am full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, my belly is like an unvented wine, like new wineskins. It is about to burst. Let me speak so that I may get relief. Let me open my lips and answer. So he's listened to all these speeches. And now he feels it's his turn. He wants to refute some of these arguments. So how would you sum up his critique of what he's heard as he's listened? What about Job? How does he feel about Job and what he has said?
By himself.
Over and over the argument was, you have sinned. You have sinned. And they grew increasingly more accusatory as the book went along, but never could, as Elihu put it, actually nail down what he had done. So a few statements that he makes to Job that kind of sums up his problem with him there in chapter 33, beginning in verse 5. Refute me if you can. Array yourself before me. Take your stand. Behold, I belong to God like you. I too have been formed out of the clay. Behold, no fear of me should terrify you, nor should my pressure weigh heavily on you. Job had made the comment throughout the book that he was ready to stand, as Stephen said, and contend with the Lord. He'd prepared his case. He was ready to go. But then later on he would say, but no matter what I say, how am I going to, you know, that back and forth that Trevor talked about. He was ready to contend, yet he knew nothing he said could stand up against the Lord. So Elihu's saying, well, I'm human. Let's try it out on me. Go ahead. Let's get started. Let me hear your case, is how I read what he says there. Job had contended that the Lord would not answer him. Elihu argues back to that there in verse 13. Why do you complain against him that he does not give an account of all his doings? Indeed, God speaks once or twice, yet no one notices it. In a dream, a vision of the night, when sound sleep falls on men, when they slumber in their bed, then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction, that he may turn man aside from his conduct and keep man from pride. He keeps his soul back from the pit and his life from passing over into Sheol. The Lord speaks to avert men of their, or to turn men from their sin, he says. But men refuse to listen. And then later on in that chapter, that same argument, behold, God does all these oftentimes with men to bring back his soul from the pit. Then over in chapter 34, he makes the contention that God, of course, can do no wickedness. There in verse 10 of chapter 34, therefore listen to me, you men of understanding, far be it from God to do wickedness and from the Almighty to do wrong, for he pays a man according to his work and makes him find it according to his way. Surely God will not act wickedly and the Almighty will not pervert justice. For his eyes are upon the ways of man, there in verse 34 again, and he sees all his steps. And then talking about Job, for he adds rebellion to his sin, he claps his hand among us and multiplies his words against God. So those are his contentions with Job. He tells him, he's heard your case, now you must wait for his judgment. There in 35 and 14, the case is before him, you must wait to hear what he says. And then he warns him again there toward the end, beware that wrath does not entice you to scoffing, that mocking attitude. And then as Elihu finishes his comments there, it's almost a preview of what God will say in the next four chapters. He talks about God and what he's done, what he's capable of, how much higher he is than us. And then we come to that very special section where God answers Job and these three men. Speaks from the whirlwind. This is one of those places that we see the reaction of people standing in the presence of the Lord. We don't get many glimpses of that in Scripture. The people at Mount Sinai and their reaction as they saw God and his power. You think of Isaiah, I'm undone, as he stood in God's presence. John falling to his knees in Revelation. So this is one of those places, and it has a profound effect on us. You can tell Stephen it has a problem, because any time he talks about anybody with any sort of arrogance, the hand automatically goes to the mouth. It's that reaction that Job had, and it shows us how we should feel as we approach him. Who dares darken counsel without knowledge was his question for him. Gird up your loins like a man. You ever had your father answer you that way? Gird up your loins. You want to be a man? Let's talk. And that's almost the sense I get here. God is telling Job, you asked for it. Let the hearing begin. You've requested it. Now let's go. And it's always interesting that there's no mention of the suffering, of the suffering's origin. As far as we know, he never got an answer. And then the questioning began. We, of course, won't have time to read those chapters. Beautiful, beautiful language, some of the most beautiful language in the Bible. Think about all those questions that he asked. Where were you? Who did? Who has? Do you know? Have you? Could you? Can you? Do you? So very direct questions at Job. And then, of course, all those questions having to do with his creation, his universe, the instincts he put in the animals around, those great beasts, the behemoth and the Leviathan. So what was Job's reaction? Of course, go ahead. No, you're fine.
Sorry. Yeah, over the whole Job.
Absolutely. That whole last chapter and a half is such a preview to what God says. It's incredible. All right, Job's reaction. The words he used, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I've spoken, I will not answer. Even twice, I will add nothing more. And then 42, 1 through 6, a very similar reaction. This is a man that has been laid low, who has been forced to consider what he had been saying over these last few chapters. And the suffering all of a sudden is much less a concern. I'm sure it's still there. He's still in pain. He's still in anguish. But he sees the Lord's point. God's message for the three friends. Anybody want to sum that up? Absolutely. You know, this had to be a slap in the face for these three, as they had become increasingly indignant as it went on. because you have not spoken of me what is right as Job has, he must make a plea on your behalf. He must offer offerings and pray for you. And of course, he did that. Job's reward for his faithfulness, more blessed than ever before. Blessed with twice the riches, whether that's literal or not, but certainly more blessed. 7 more sons, 3 very beautiful daughters, the most beautiful in the land. And then long life, as we mentioned, I think 140 years, 4 generations he would live or to see after that. So very blessed for his endurance. All right, lessons from Job. I'll give you mine, and then you can add any more. We had already talked about this one before, and it is the obvious lesson because James tells us it's the lesson. God's compassion and his mercy. Through Job's endurance, he was blessed. God wanted a mediator between himself and God. He wanted an audience with God. God granted him that and certainly had compassion and mercy on him and restored him fully once this was over. To Trevor's point there in 13:15, though he slay me, I will trust him. Chapter 19, that verse about I know my Redeemer lives. Ultimately, Job did trust the Lord, and we should as well. We do not know his purposes any more than Job did and can stand in argument or have no more right to stand in argument than he, and maybe even less. He owes us no answers, just like he owed Job no answers. He is far and away sovereign and above us. The 3 friends and the wife, if Satan can't find a weakness inside, he'll attack us from the outside. I think that's a very big lesson from the book that we can see. We, of course, have no security in our physical blessings, just as Job didn't. Job, in that stretch there, 29:18-20, he talks about, I was secure. I thought I would die in my nest. I thought everything was going to remain just as it was. And then, of course, his world was turned upside down. Human perception, of course, is no indicator of man's righteousness or his wickedness, as we can see from Elihu's answer to those 3 men, nor of God's approval or disapproval. And then my final lesson, standing in God's presence, what it means, what effect it should have on us as we consider that. Any others to add to that?
Found to be false.
And as Stephen said, there were right points intermingled in those arguments. Eliphaz argued from what he had seen, of course, Zophar from tradition. So, yes, definitely.
It's not just the church.
It's almost as if they have been convinced themselves as they go along, because especially Eliphaz at the first, he praises how good a man Job had been. Any others? Trevor? Absolutely. Good point. Daniel? Sam? Trevor? That'll be one of the discussions we'll have in Ecclesiastes, I'm sure. Life's not always fair. All right. Thank you for your comments on Job. We will move now into the book of Proverbs. As I said, we're in a short overview of these 4 books. We'll devote most of our quarter to Psalms a little bit down the road. But we want to take a couple of lessons here, and a lesson and a half maybe now, because we're behind definitely now. We were okay. To know wisdom and instruction, there in chapter 1 and verse 1, and then down in verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. So Proverbs is wisdom for the man truly seeking to please Jehovah, that Lord there is Yahweh, is the original, which is used predominantly in the book, which is pretty interesting. If my search was correct, Elohim is only used 5 times, I think. Yahweh occurs 82 times. So it was a very directed wisdom toward God's people, as I see that. So the godly man, what he should seek, what he should avoid, and that's the purpose of the book. As I said, we recently went through a quarter on Proverbs. Matt, are they all concrete I remember you making this point. Is this absolutely going to happen if you do this?
General principles.
General principles, yes. Excuse me. They are generally true. They are the best way to live your life, to have the best outcome, the best chance at the best outcome. Short statements, generally, very short. Pithy is another word that's used. We might use axiom or maxims. General truths expressing advice from gleaned from experience would be what they are. The word proverbs comes from the Latin proverbium. Pro meaning to put forth. Verbum means word. So that's the origin of the word. Most civilizations have proverbs. These little short statements. Think of our own. A stitch in time saves nine. Or waste not, want not. A penny saved is a penny earned. Those type of things. Very good wisdom to have. But of course, this is wisdom that came from God. It is the wisdom that He chose through His inspiration and providence to include for us. The Waldrons, I mentioned this in the introduction, the Waldrons use that term, distilled wisdom of the ages. When you distill something, you extract the desirable part, the important part of something, and that is this book indeed. It pulls out those important parts of the way we live our life and tells us how to do so in a godly way. Some common terms, while we're not necessarily drawing from the Waldron books this quarter, there are times when he defines terms I think that are very valuable. And this is one of those. We'll look at a few that he uses in Ecclesiastes when we get there. But three terms that he uses here that are very key to understanding the book. The fool. The fool is the one who refuses to learn the lessons that are directly in front of him. He may not recognize or just may be oblivious to the pitfalls that lay ahead. He may repeat mistakes made over and over again without learning the lessons that are obvious from those. Or, as is the case a lot of the places in the book, he may simply ignore the sage advice that is given to him. And we've likely all fell into one of those categories at some point in our life. The simple one. The young one, the inexperienced one, he doesn't have the benefit of having those mistakes that he can learn from. He's naive. He's running headlong into trouble. That's the sense of the simple one in the book. He's encouraged many times to learn from others' experience, to open his eyes and see what lay ahead. And then, of course, the wise man, the experienced man, he's learned from his own mistakes. He's learned from the mistakes of others. He's alert to the pitfalls around him, and of course his foundation is that fear of the Lord. That is wisdom found in the book. Any other introductory comments before we go into the questions?
Luck favors the both of those things.
Absolutely. Context would determine a lot of that, for sure. All right, the three men listed as the authors of the book. The first one, of course, Solomon. We know from 1 Kings of his 3,000 Proverbs. We've already talked about that. Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 1 talks about the Proverbs that Hezekiah commissioned be copied a couple of hundred years later. And then there was an interesting one there in Ecclesiastes as it applies to Solomon. Chapter 12, verses 9 and 10 says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to define delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. So it shows there that Solomon indeed put a lot of thought into the proverbs as he recorded them and assembled them. The other two that are mentioned, Agur, and King Lemuel. Can't even find much speculation on who they may be. Some think there may be other names for Solomon. Outside of that, I didn't really see any speculation. There's not much questioning its place in Scripture. It's rarely questioned. It's quoted in the New Testament several times, almost directly. And Jesus himself talked about Solomon and his wisdom as the Queen of the South came to visit it. So it's rarely questioned that it has a place in the canon. The purpose of the book, there in chapter 1, to know wisdom and instruction. Wisdom there, Strong's uses the word shrewd or prudent, the ability to see things as they truly are. And in instruction is kind of associated with discipline, the discipline to apply that wisdom that's gained. The next purpose, to discern or perceive, to have insight to that knowledge that's there. To receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, all those things that would be beneficial. And be willing to receive that. That's the purpose of the book. Give prudence to the naive, that simple one that we talked about. Knowledge and discretion to the youth. So, to be able to follow that advice that you see there. To increase in learning for the wise. The wise never stop learning and will continue to do so. So this is the benefit of the book, is for them to increase their wisdom. Wise counsel for a man of understanding. Direction, guidance for that man that does seek to please the Lord. And then understanding the proverb or figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. So that word understand, to separate mentally, is how Strong described the original word there. Distinguish. So proverbs are something we ponder over. And it's, as I would read through, I would catch myself coming across one and then start thinking about it. And then I've lost 10, 15 minutes in study time. So they are something to be pondered over. You come across a new one every time you read, or at least I do, one that I hadn't thought of in a certain way. And that's the beauty of the book and why it is still relevant to us today. What's the familiar perspective from which most of the book, or at least a third of the book, is given? Yeah. So advice from a father to his young son. A couple of three verses there. Chapter 1, verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Chapter 2, verse 1. My son, if you will receive my words and treasure my commandments within you. Chapter 3, verse 1. My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. So, indeed, that's the perception, or the perspective from which the advice is given, from that father to the son.
God put myself as your son.
Oh, absolutely. While it gives us a very familiar perspective, yeah, it is our Father speaking to us ultimately, and we should consider it that way. I think we'll stop there. We'll pick up there. We're just about out of time. We'll pick up there and try to get most of the way through. We're less than a half lesson behind, Stephen, so we're doing good. We'll catch up. So we'll start there on Wednesday night and get as close as we can to finishing the book. Thank you for your comments.